discussion on the minor prophets this evening, and I have the opportunity to talk about Zephaniah as we learn together about this book and about this minor prophet. And as we look at Zephaniah, we're going to touch on kind of the what's woven through the book, which is impending judgment and distant hope. These two verses really illustrate this book very well. In Zephaniah chapter 1, verse 15, if you want to open your Bibles to Zephaniah, we'll be there all evening. A day of wrath is that day, a day of distress and anguish, a day of ruin and devastation, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness. Now that's opposed to, as we get to the end of the book, in Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 17, the Lord your God is in your midst, a mighty one who will save. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will quiet you by his love. He will exult over you with loud singing. Two completely opposite ends of the spectrum as we move through this book. One, the terrible day of the Lord is coming. The other, there's hope. He's in the midst of you. He'll exalt over you with loud singing. Some facts about Zephaniah. And first and foremost, is James Bryant in here? No, he's not in here right now. Oh, he's up there. Okay, so we'll just get this out of the way. This is three chapters, 53 verses. So I don't know if this is shorter or a little longer than yours.
You got about like 10 verses.
All right, so yeah. So we're going to read very slowly tonight because we've only got 53 verses to talk about. Just kidding. We've got a lot of opportunity to discuss God and Zephaniah's prophecies. And first, his name, and this is, there's several different interpretations of Zephaniah's name. Two of those, one is hidden of the eternal. The other is Yahweh has hidden. So plays off of the same translation. He is the only royal prophet. So he was of royal lineage. He was the son of Cushai and great-great-grandson of King Hezekiah. It was written between 640 and 609 B.C., and he's ninth in the literary order of how they're laid out within the Old Testament. His place of activity is assumed to be Jerusalem. He does reference Jerusalem, so the activity that where he's prophesying, where he's speaking, is assumed to be Jerusalem, although it didn't come out and say, I'm right here in Jerusalem. The typical assumption by historians and biblical scholars is that he was in Jerusalem. He was contemporary with Nahum, Jeremiah, and Habakkuk. Nahum was talking about the devastation of Nineveh and of the Assyrian Empire. Jeremiah was pleading with those remaining to return to God. Habakkuk was just a few years later, and he was revealing the judgment on Judah, the actual event that was going to happen. King Josiah was in power at the time of his prophecy, and we'll spend a little time on Josiah tonight. But it's important to note that although Josiah was considered a reformer, Zephaniah does not mention any of his reforms or changes that were brought about in Judah by Josiah. The northern kingdom at this time is gone. It's in captivity. There is no northern kingdom. Judah is the remnant. They are the remaining kingdom. Under Ammon and Manasseh, Baal worship and Ashtoreth worship, and we'll talk about Milcom as well, worship was very prevalent, and this was bringing about cultural and moral decay, big time. And we'll talk about what that really was like during this time frame. And although not directly mentioned by Zephaniah, Babylon later on would be used to punish Judah. Babylon at this point had not risen to their zenith. They weren't the all-powerful Babylon just yet. They were on the rise. This was what the kingdom looked like at that time. And you can see you've got Samaria, you've got the Assyrian Empire here, you've got Moab, they're cut off here. So Judah is right here, and this is who we're going to spend our time talking about and who God is looking to punish within this book, within the prophecy. Now, we're going to go back for just a second, and we're going to expand on one of those facts. King Josiah ruled from 649 to 609 BC in that same time frame. So he was the ruler of Judah when Zephaniah was prophesying. He became king at the age of 8 years old. The reason he became king is because of his predecessor, who was Amon, his father, the second bullet point there under king at the age of eight. Amon was assassinated by his own servants. He only ruled about 2 years. He was extremely bad. He was not a good guy. The example for Amon, though, was set by his father, Manasseh. Manasseh was a murderous, evil king. The streets were awash with blood during his rule. However, he did return to God at the end when the invaders were knocking at the door, coming to take him off into captivity. He actually returned to God, but it wasn't enough to influence his son, Amon, right? So it certainly illustrates the example that is set by the father, especially early on, is oftentimes followed by the son. And even though, you know, he came back, at the end, it wasn't enough to keep his son Amon, who took the throne, from being as evil as he was and so despised that his own servants did away with him. So that led us to Josiah's rule. And Josiah reigned for about 31 years. And I didn't note it here, but at the end of that 31 years, he was actually killed in battle. There's two translations, and actually Caleb touched on it a bit. One says, in one book it says he was, you know, killed on the battlefield. The other says they took him back to the kingdom and he died there, but it was the same outcome, right? So it's like he actually received the death wound on the battlefield, regardless of where he really died. But Josiah, at the end, actually got in a little trouble because Egypt was coming through his land to battle somebody else. He decided to intervene and step between Egypt's enemy and Egypt. The Egypt pharaoh said, hey, I ain't got any quarrel with you. I'm going out to fight these guys. But Josiah stepped in the middle of them. And frankly, it was contrary to God's wishes. So Josiah's reign ended at that 31 years. However, now looking at Josiah's life, he is one of the kings mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew. Under his rule, there weren't any foreign invaders at that time, so Jerusalem actually flourished. They were self-governing. They didn't have somebody else overseeing them. They didn't have another empire overseeing them. So they actually were doing okay under Josiah. During his reign, when he was about 26, he ordered high priest Hilkiah to rebuild the temple. So does anybody remember what Hilkiah found? Book of the Law, that's right. So Hilkiah found the Book of the Law in the treasure room. Go figure, right? You know, the law of God is in the treasure room. So it makes kind of sense, right? Well, Hilkiah rediscovers it. And we'll talk about why he had to rediscover it here in just a second. But he had to actually go and he ran to the king, said, hey, you got to read this book, right? So Hilkiah is actually kind of spreading the good news. He's saying, I found the law of God. You've got to read this. And because of that revealing and that reading of the word, Josiah set about reforming Judah. He said he was not only, it was just reading the book and hit him like, oh man, you know, it'd be great to follow God, right? It was also, he was fearful because it described the calamities that would befall those who were disobedient to God. And Josiah realized, we are way down that path. So we've got to do something. So Josiah started them back on the trek to God, and he set to clean the land of idolatry and return to the law. Now, when we talk about cleanse from idolatry, idolatry, it wasn't just bowing down and worshiping an idol. These were evil practices that the Israelites were engaged in, that the tribe of Judah was engaged in. You get some illustrations on the right-hand side of some of the emblems and some of the statues and a drawing of this worship. There was three that are that come out as the major ones that a lot of the people followed, although there were a lot of minor gods that they had picked up from foreigners as well. This was prevalent in the temple. This was not just freestanding buildings that they had built off to the side and the temples were still operating. They had brought these emblems, these practices, this pagan worship right into the temple, the sanctuary within the temple, all pieces and parts of it. Baal worship. Baal was considered to be a supreme god. Fertility, sun, storm. Also, how they worshiped these gods varied across the land as well. Some of them would say, okay, Baal is the god of all of this, right? Then others would say, well, no, he's just the god of the sun or of the storms. So they would worship other gods that were gods of fertility and of weather. So there was a mixture of how Baal worship was conducted throughout the land and the other gods as well. Baal required human sacrifice of the firstborn. Talk about that more in a second. Blood from priests was self-inflicted injury. And I didn't realize this, but there are parts of the world that still subscribe to this. There are some actual pictures of them cutting themselves, of cutting young boys to bring about blood to sacrifice to Baal. So Baal worship is not totally dead. There are still some remote areas where this still happens. Astaroth worship, female goddess of fertility, nature, and war. She came in with the Phoenicians and the Sidonians. Whole families worshipped Astaroth, and often women led. So the women led the ceremonies. They also led their families into this pagan practice. Now, if you had a supposition here, and you said, well, why were they women led? Well, it could have been that the tribe of Judah was marrying women from foreign lands, right, as they came in. And remember, Jerusalem, this area was flourishing that time. They were part of a major trade route. So if they intermarried, then the women could have been bringing some of these practices with them. Thus, women led, leading whole families into this pagan worship. Astaroth, though, did not require human sacrifices. So a little bit gentler pagan practice. The sacrifices typically were fires. They were baking cakes as offering. libations, alcoholic beverages, you know, poured out on the altars and consumed during the worship so that they were in a stupor while they were offering up their worship to these pagan gods. Milcom or Molech? The translation, the ESV says Milcom. As you look at Milcom, Milcom translates into a couple of different words, but Molech worship is another translation for that. It was the chief god of the Ammonites and also worshipped by the Phoenicians and the Canaanites, required child sacrifice. And there's a note here, and I don't know if you can read it because it's kind of small, but from Diodorus, that's kind of a funny word, but Diodorus Siculus, he wrote about this worship practice. And what he wrote was, this is a quote from him, there was in their city a bronze image extending its hands, palms up, and sloping toward the ground so that each of the children, when placed thereon, rolled down and fell into a sort of gaping pit filled with fire. So they sacrificed their children. They thought it was pleasing, and they actually lined up to do it. They wanted to sacrifice their children because they thought it would bring blessings on them for their crops, for their lives, that it would bring blessings on the rest of the family. So they would sacrifice their children. Some of this also, and this was prevalent in Baal worship as well. The story that you hear often is that the hands were together and that babies were laid into the hands and the hands were molten hot. So the babies were literally burned alive as part of that sacrifice. So very cruel and terrible worship practices. This is what's happening at the first part of Josiah's reign. This is what's happening during Zephaniah as he starts prophesying. So it's not just, yeah, the people have made a golden calf and they're bowing down to it. This is horrible pagan practice. It is the worst kind of pagan practice that you could possibly imagine. Now, think about Josiah as the king. He had to be aware of these practices. He had to know what was going on. Did he participate in them? Don't know. But certainly, when he got the law and he read about what would happen for those who were disobedient to the God of Israel, he was fearful. He knew, I've got to do something to turn this thing around. So what Josiah did, very importantly, is he moved the nation away and he bought some time for Judah. Because God was ready. He was ready to bring his wrath on Judah. Josiah bought a little bit more time. Zephaniah, however, through his prophecy and through his revealing and through God, knew that although Josiah had put it back on the right track, it wasn't going to last, right? That people, time after time after time, they go back to God, they leave God. They go back to God, they leave God. You know, when it makes you think about, it's really easy to be close to God when things are good, right? Some have a hard time being close to God when times are bad. And that's really the time you need Him most. You need the family. You need the brethren the most, right? You know, it's wonderful to share the good times. But it is absolutely wonderful to have the brethren there during the bad times to help you through it, right? But these, as we read in the Old Testament and we certainly look at the lessons that are set out before us, you know, stay on the path. That's the message, right? If you look at the Old Testament and you think, man, it's like watching a movie. And you see the guy that's walking down the basement stairs in the dark without a flashlight in the dead of night, something that I just wouldn't do, right? If there's anything down there, I'll just wait for it to come up, right? But and you know he's going to get it. And he does, right? Well, same thing. As you're looking at the Old Testament, you think, why can't they learn? They were at the height of evil, pagan worship. They realized they're wrong. They moved away from that. But it didn't last. Stay on the path. Keep headed towards the light. You know, we're told time and time again, don't turn loose of his hand. He's not turning loose of yours. It's your choice. So as we look at Zephaniah tonight, and we look at the theme of Zephaniah, it's about the day of the Lord. And when you talk about whether it is historically looking at the Old Testament and looking at what that meant to the Israelites, what it meant to the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, or whether you're looking at it today, when you hear the words, the day of the Lord, what comes to mind? What's the first thing that comes to your mind? Good, you said? Judgment. That's right. Judgment. Judgment has a connotation that's like, oh, not all that great, right? It's like, boy, that day's coming. The day of God means judgment. Now, for those of us in the Lord and for the faithful, that shouldn't be a fearful thing, right? In fact, we should want it. We should want it to come. But for those that aren't right, that aren't on the path, that aren't following, well, it is a fearful thing. You know, that's what Josiah saw, right? He saw, man, we couldn't possibly be any further away from God than we are right now. So the word, the phrase, the day of the Lord is used 5 times in 3 chapters. This is a dual prophecy. The impending doom and future redemption, though. That's the great thing, right? There was still a path back. God did not want to sacrifice Judah. Although we'll read in the scriptures here in just a little while, that's exactly what he had prepared them. The description that is used is God prepared Judah as the sacrifice, right? To show the world. But it wasn't going to be limited to just Judah, and we'll get into that. It also has the dual prophecy. It also has short-term and long-term meanings. You know, prophetically as judgment on a particular nation. But also is referencing the future, the first century, as we look at the references here to the judgment, to those who return to God. We can certainly look at this in the messianic prophecy view. We can certainly look at this as we look at the similarities of redemptions that are available, that are woven throughout the New Testament, right? So there's meaning here, very hard meaning that you can actually extract and say, you know what, this applies to me now. This applies to me today. Now, he's writing about Judah. He's writing about those nations. Don't mistake that. But the meaning, the inference here is far reaching beyond that. And we'll touch on those scriptures as we go through it this evening. As we look at just quickly, the day of the Lord is at hand. The great day of the Lord is near. The day of the Lord's wrath, God's fury. The day of the Lord's anger, all of those have that message, that sense, that aura of impending doom. In our outline, one way of looking at it is in 3 parts as you look at the 3 chapters, right? Although they overlap just a little bit, you can look at it as the day of the Lord in chapter 1, so prophecies concerning the entire earth, prophecies regarding Judah and Jerusalem, and God's wrath on a rebellious mankind. The nations are warned of the coming judgment in chapters 2 and the first part of chapter 3. Repentant, meek are spared. Surrounding nations warned of impending judgment. The entire earth will be punished. Now that's where the meaning of this starts expanding out just a little bit, is it starts reaching beyond just Judah and those who are immediately persecuting those to the rest of the world too. There is ultimate deliverance in chapter 3. The people are restored. This is great, as we'll read through this in just a few minutes, but a pure language will be taught. God dwells with his people. So as bad as the prophecy starts out, and as strong and as direct as the prophecy is, we're going to see that there is a path back. There's always an open door. God always wants you, me, Judeans, the surrounding nations, the world. He wants you to come back. He doesn't want to punish. You know, we hear God is a God of love, and he is absolutely a God of love. But some of that love is teaching your children a lesson. And it is allowing your children at times to make decisions that you know may not be the best decision in the world. Now what we're going to do is, we've got 53 verses, and I think we've got plenty of time to actually read through these 53 verses together, and then we'll extract some information as we read through that. We'll extract some meaning of those and how it applied not only then, but how it can apply to us today. So if you would, open your Bibles, if you hadn't already, to Zephaniah chapter 1. We're going to start in verses 1 through 6. And this is God's punishment is coming on his people. And you can't get any better than actually reading this book, right? So I can talk about it a lot and tell you what these verses is chunks may be referencing according to, you know, as I look at them and other scholars have studied them. But as you read them together, you're going to hear the directness. There's no beating around the bush here. So starting in verse 1, the word of the Lord that came to Zephaniah, the son of Cushai, son of Gedaliah, son of Amariah, son of Hezekiah, in the days of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah. I will utterly sweep away everything from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I will sweep away man and beast. I will sweep away the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea and the rubble with the wicked. I will cut off mankind from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I will stretch out my hand against Judah and against all the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And I will cut off from this place the remnant of Baal and the name of the idolatrous priests along with the priests, those who bow down on roofs to the host of the heavens, those who bow down and swear to the Lord and yet swear by Milcom, those who have turned back from following the Lord, who do not seek the Lord or inquire of him. It doesn't get any more direct, does it? Zephaniah is saying it like it is. He is absolutely speaking the truth, the direct truth, saying, look, God's not playing around. It's here. It's coming. It's going to happen. Prophecies against Jerusalem would be fulfilled shortly after Zephaniah's time frame, or towards the end of his time frame, by Babylon. From 606 to about 586 B.C. is when the Babylons rose and came in and took away Judah. Now, that's you as a people, you as the earth, you as everybody, you're all going to be punished, right? Now we're going to get more specific in the next few verses. In verses 7 through 13, let's jump down a little bit. Be silent before the Lord God. For the day of the Lord is near. The Lord has prepared a sacrifice and consecrated his guests. And on that day of the Lord's sacrifice, I will punish the officials and the king's sons and all who array themselves in foreign attire. On that day, I will punish everyone who leaps over the threshold and those who fill their master's house with violence and fraud. On that day, declares the Lord, a cry will be heard from the fish gate, a wail from the second quarter, a loud crash from the hills. Wail, O inhabitants of the mortar, for all the traitors are no more. All who weigh out silver are cut off. At that time, I will search Jerusalem with lamps, and I will punish the men who are complacent, those who say in their hearts, The Lord will not do good, nor will he do ill. Their God shall be plundered and their houses laid waste. Though they built houses, they shall not inhabit them. Though they plant vineyards, they shall not drink wine from them. So you've got all the men of Judah, all the officials of Judah, the priests. Jump back up to verse 9. On that day I will punish everyone who leaps over the threshold and those who fill their master's house with violence and fraud. The priests were as guilty, guiltier. They're indicted even more strongly a little bit later. The priests were letting the people go astray. They left the law. They abandoned the rightful practices in the temple. They were allowing things to happen. The kings, their sons, businessmen. Why would businessmen be indicted, right? It's like, why? Merchants and businessmen, why would they be indicted? Well, guess what? Major trade route, right? The kind of business they're conducting, the practices they're bringing, maybe some of the goods, the emblems that are used in the worship of these pagan gods are being bought and sold. They're dealing with people who are not right. Talks about a well from the fish gate. The fish gate was actually a gate It was a north gate of the second quarter of Jerusalem, and Manasseh built it back. And the gate was being rebuilt during the time of Nehemiah, and most likely, because I got curious, why was it called the fish gate? Well, probably because it was close to the fish market. That was just there was no other significance other than it was just that easy reference, right? But it's talking about the welling, even at the fish gate, even at the gates of Jerusalem, there's going to be welling. There's going to be, you know, God's coming. He's going to judge every individual. And guess what, complacent people? People who are just professing, yeah, God is. God doesn't do anything. Think that upset God? God, he neither does good nor bad. Yeah, make you think of today, people go, well, yeah, I believe in God. And then it stops right there, right? I believe in God. Well, if you do, why aren't you doing something active, right? Why aren't you making, you know, moving forward? Complacency gets you indicted just as bad as if you were doing the pagan religion. Just as bad, just as if you were doing those evil things. Letting it happen is as bad as participating in it happening. In verses 14 through 18, as we close out chapter 1, nothing can deliver the people from the coming judgment. The great day of the Lord is near, near and hastening fast. The sound of the day of the Lord is bitter. The mighty man cries aloud there. A day of wrath is that day, a day of distress and anguish, a day of ruin and devastation, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness, a day of trumpet blast and battle cry against the fortified cities and against the lofty embattlements. I will bring distress on mankind so that they shall walk like the blind because they have sinned against the Lord. Their blood shall be poured out like dust and their flesh like dung. Neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them on the day of the wrath of the Lord. In the fire of his jealousy, all the earth shall be consumed. For a full and sudden end he will make of all the inhabitants of the earth. Does that sound like the day of judgments that's coming for us? Does that sound like the day of judgment that is awaiting as the Lord returns and he judges the righteous and he judges the unrighteous? It's going to be good for a few, and it's going to be bad for a whole lot. There's no avoiding it. Your wealth, anything you're doing other than walking the path and staying on the path will not protect you from the day of judgment. It didn't protect them, and it won't protect us. Now we move on to chapter 2. And chapter 2 has 15 verses. Oops, I went the wrong way, didn't I? Chapter 2. As we look at verses 1 through 3, he not only includes Judah, but now guess who he starts talking about? Very specifically. So God's not only talking about, I'm going to destroy all nations, I'm going to destroy all mankind. He starts naming names. And we're going to see that as we move through here. Gather together, yes, gather, O shameless nation, before the decree takes effect, before the day passes away like chaff, before there comes upon you the burning anger of the Lord, before there comes upon you the day of the anger of the Lord, seek the Lord, all you humble of the land who do his just commands. Seek righteousness, seek humility. Perhaps you may be hidden on the day of the anger of the Lord. What did he just do there? Now, this is right in the middle of saying, I'm going to destroy mankind. Enough's enough. You are finished. Well, the first part of chapter 2, guess what happens? Gather together for repentance and prayer. God's anger could have been turned away if they'd have repented. They didn't. But he extends it. He says, look, repent. Seeking righteousness is the key to pleasing God. An attitude of humility. Be humble. Obedience is the natural outgrowth of humility and faith. So he stops for a second here and he says, look, I've just told you what I'm going to do. Is there anybody out there who wants to change? Is there anybody out there who wants to obey? How many parents in here have said, and how many kids in here have heard, I'm going to give you one more chance? Right? I heard that a few times growing up, and I've said it a few times over the past few years. God does that right here. He says that. They didn't obey. They didn't do it, but he does extend it. Again, it's like watching a train wreck, right? Zephaniah has a front row seat to the train wreck. He's sitting there watching it happen. He's prophesying about it. He knows it's going to come, as do his fellow prophets who are out there prophesying. The judgment of the nations, very specifically. And we won't read through all of 4 through 15, so we have time to get on chapter 3. But the Philistines were to the south. Moab and Ammon was to the east. He says Moab and Ammon are going to be like Sodom and Gomorrah. Their pride's going to be their downfall, and we know what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. They were gone. They were wiped out. Ethiopia in northern Africa is going to feel God's wrath. Assyria and its capital city, Nineveh, will be destroyed. At this time, Nineveh had not yet been destroyed. So this is where he got into. He stopped for a second and said, are there any of you? Maybe I'll hide you. Maybe I'll hide you. You'd be the remnant, which we'll talk about in chapter 3. So he said that, but then he got on to naming names. So he said, Philistines, Moab, Ammon, Ethiopia. I'm going to destroy y'all. In chapter 3, in verses 1 through 7, we look at judgment on Jerusalem and the nations. And in verses 1 through 7, God's disobedient and unfaithful people will be punished. In verse 2, this is very succinct and very direct about what the problem is. She listens to no voice. She accepts no correction. She does not trust in the Lord. She does not draw near to her God. that's it encapsulated. If you just looked at verse 2 and said, what's the problem here? Well, verse 2 says it. Not listening. Won't draw near to God. Punishment is inevitable. Josiah bought him some time. God already knew they were going to fall away again. Zephaniah knew it, because Zephaniah didn't even talk about Josiah's reforms. He knew it wasn't going to last. He knew that the tribe of Judah, kingdom of Judah, was not going to return to God, ultimately. But in verses 8 through 13, we're going to talk about the remnant of Israel. I'm going to read that. Therefore, wait for me, declares the Lord, for the day when I rise up to seize the prey. For my decision is to gather nations, to assemble kingdoms, to pour out upon them my indignation, all of my burning anger. For in the fire of my jealousy, all the earth will be consumed. For at that time I will change, this is a conversion, I will change the speech of the peoples to a pure speech. And all of them may call upon, all of them. Notice that. That's future reference, right? All of them will be able to call upon the name of the Lord and serve him with one accord. There's a huge mention there of all nations, right? Everybody can come before the Lord. Wasn't that way before, right? So that's starting to be woven in here that there's a promise. There's something that's going to be fulfilled out there that's going to allow all nations to come before God. From beyond the rivers of Cush, my worshipers, the daughter of my dispersed ones, shall bring my offering. On that day, you shall not be put to shame because of the deeds by which you have rebelled against me. For then I will remove from your midst your proudly exultant ones, and you shall no longer be haughty in my holy mountain. But I will leave in your midst a people humble and lowly. They shall seek refuge in the name of the Lord, those who are left in Israel. So he is talking about, you know what? There is going to be a remnant. There is going to be some folks who turn back to God. Now, unfortunately, they're going to be pulled along with the current here, right? But there's going to be that remnant. And again, all nations are going to be able to come before God and ask for his mercy and his grace. And then in 14 through 20, as we close out the book, rejoicing in Jerusalem, God will shower his people with blessings. God will remove their enemies in sorrow. God will allow them to worship him again and remove the shame of their exile. God will dwell among his people and be their God. God will turn their shame to praise and renown. There's a strong reference there as we're closing out the book. I didn't asterisk, but you know, reference to the Messiah, right? Reference to messianic prophecy. Reference to the kingdom. And the return also from the Babylonian captivity. So woven in here, certainly, as we look at these books, and I think that's real important as we're moving towards the end of the study of the minor prophets, is it's not just history, it's actual lessons for us to learn that we can look at our lives and individuals and say, am I on the path? Have I fallen away? Am I as guilty as the ones who were complacent? Am I as guilty as the businessmen and the merchants who were doing things they shouldn't have been doing and trading in ways they shouldn't have been trading? And as we're getting class come in, we'll close out with this slide. Some lessons we can pick up from Zephaniah. Judgment will be beyond description. The adjectives and the visual that's painted right off the bat in chapter 1 of Zephaniah, it says thick darkness. Have you ever been to Ruby Falls when they turn off all the lights and it's almost, the darkness is so thick, you feel like you can almost touch it, right? It's that black, it's that dark. And you think of that as it's being illustrated. Judgment will fall on all, including the unfaithful among God's people. A remnant will be delivered. Jehovah is the God of the universe, the only God, the only true God. People can worship, people can fall away and follow other gods. God is God. True joy will eventually come through the restoration of the remnant as they came out of Babylonian captivity. to today as we obey Christ. All people, regardless of your income, your station in life, you're going to be held accountable for your sins. We are going to be held accountable just as they were. So if you had to look at this and say, well, goodness, these people right in the middle of a great awakening for during Josiah's reign to come back to God, well, guess what? Sustained actions must follow the desire to change. You can want to change. You can want to do something all you want. But unless you take an action, you can't change. You can think, man, I wish I could lose a few pounds. Well, unless you do something, it's not going to happen. You can think, I wish I could play the violin. Well, unless you pick up a violin and take sustained actions, it's not going to happen. Same with God. You can have a desire to change. You can have a desire. You can actually go through some motions. But you still have to walk the path. You still have to have sustained action after obedience. Thanks for tonight. I appreciate the opportunity to get to speak tonight and to get to share Zephaniah with you. So I think we got a couple minutes here in between, and then we'll have our devotional.